much more. Again, White and Tackett. As postmodernists, our view of the world is text-centered. Everything can be seen as text. All phenomena and events can be regarded as text. Hence, a meeting, a war, a holiday, buying a car, speech, and so on can all be assigned the order of text. Furthermore, these texts are also interconnected in that each system of signs can be transferred into others. An endless connection between texts with no prospect of ever arriving at an agreed point. Thus, meaning is endlessly deferred. Everything is related to everything else. I have news for White and Tackett. Everything is not related to everything else. That extreme position is the stuff of comic novels, such as Douglas Adams's Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency series, but not of serious scholarship. If everything is text, then the word text loses meaning. A war and a holiday may have something in common. They are both human activities, for instance. But that something in common is simply too general to get much mileage out of it. Following the postmodernist route, we may indeed never arrive at meaning, but not because meaning is not there, only because we are lost in endless linguistic games that are entirely beside the point. White and Tackett claim to be performing nothing short of an autopsy of the modern expert, and one may wonder what qualifies them to do so. Not to worry. We find their position about their own work on the second page of the paper. It might appear that this paper is tending to write authoritatively about our aims. We would like to say that this is a postmodern text, and that no such reading should be sought. As authors, we do not wish to be authorities in its interpretation. I warned you, I wasn't making this stuff up. What does it mean for the authors of a text? An article really does qualify as text, and those who wrote it really are authors, to tell their readers that the authors themselves do not have any authority in the interpretation of what they wrote. Did they write random gibberish with no intention to communicate a specific message? It appears not, since White and Tackett are very specific about what they want to say and why. But they better take some responsibility for it, or one begins to question what the point of the whole exercise actually is. Indeed, it is responsibility itself with which White and Tackett have a problem. Experts can neither claim causal agency nor imply social responsibility. The expert, as a causal agent, who is the authority on cause, privileges him or herself, or sets him or herself aside from the cause itself. Such strong claims on causality become untenable if we note that everything is related to everything else. In this postmodern world, experts are not allowed to take the credit nor hold responsibility for disasters. They are a tiny part of a complex exchange. This means an end to the idea of an individual moral agency. Okay. Let me get this straight. Since, according to White and Tackett, everything is connected to everything else, which is not true, then any given individual cannot play a significant causal role in anything, presumably because causality is distributed throughout the universe, and therefore nobody can take credit or blame for anything. The implications of this sort of reasoning for society would be staggering if anyone but a few misguided souls actually took it seriously. Indeed, I'm pretty sure one can make the case that not even White and Tackett truly believe what they are saying. For instance, suppose the authors live in an apartment building that was built by a particular construction company, following the plans laid out by a particular group of engineers. Now, let us suppose further that the building suddenly collapses and that the subsequent investigation of what happens pins responsibility squarely on the shoulders of the engineers, who, in a flagrant effort to save a few dollars, had produced a technically flawed design. Are we to understand that White and Tackett would forego their right to sue because everything is connected to everything else, and therefore nobody can be blamed for anything? I doubt it. Then again, maybe they wouldn't sue. In their paper, they actually examine a case involving engineering. We can say that in the construction of a bridge, a certain scientific knowledge is deployed, and it may require a certain applied science to provide data on the details of the bridge's construction. But the creation of a bridge is a design exercise which is not wholly based on scientific data. It is based on its functions with associated costs, which would have to be balanced with uncertainty and conflicting values. It is not just a question of optimizing a model. Further complications will arise, for example, concerns of local residents and issues such as displacement, the environment, and so on. Notice the use of scare quotes around applied science, as if the authors only grudgingly acknowledge the existence of any form of scientific expertise. As with much postmodernist literature, what they write in this instance is either trivially true or outrageously false. The trivially true interpretation is that, of course, there is more than engineering to the construction of a bridge. There are, in fact, plenty of social, economic, and cultural issues coalescing to form the broad picture. But whether the bridge is well designed or not is solely a matter of engineering, and the rest simply doesn't enter into it. This implies that if the bridge collapses because of a design flaw, the engineers are both legally and morally responsible for the disaster. The alternative interpretation of what White and Tackett are saying, however, denies this very conclusion, claiming that somehow the fact that bridges are built not just through engineering, but also as an outcome of a variety of societal factors, absolves engineers of any responsibility, and for that matter, denies them any praise for their work. This is nonsense on stilts in the utmost degree. White and Tackett, like so many postmodernists, clearly have a problem with science, presumably because science is often considered an authority, and, to be sure, not always for the right reasons. But it is one thing to level a measured criticism aimed at the abuses of science, and quite another to call for an outright rejection of the whole practice because one is, in principle, against authority tot quort. The expert has no authority over the text. Remember that text here means pretty much anything and everything produced by human beings. No postmodernist would really believe that the expert has the right answers, only that they act, consciously or unconsciously, to monopolize authority. Insisting on the impartiality of expertise may be a pretense for imposing a view, thereby making the expert an instrument of power. Notice here the use of a common logical fallacy, that of introducing a false dichotomy. According to White and Tackett, there are only two possibilities. Either experts have the right answers, or they are simply acting to impose their view in a quest for power. For a postmodernist, there cannot be any such thing as a right answer, so, given the two choices, it must be the latter. But the real world is more complicated than that. Experts often do have a good answer to a given question, but not always. Sometimes there may be more than one possible answer. Moreover, the expert could be both right and seeking to impose a particular opinion out of conscious or unconscious motives. But to dismiss someone's arguments on the basis of his motives constitutes yet another logical fallacy, known as the genetic fallacy. Motives, as important and perhaps at times suggestive as they may be, still ought to be considered separately from the reasons supplied for a given answer. This, shall we say, irrational disdain for rationality reaches its apotheosis in White and Tackett's paper when they write that, following Liotard, we would contest this view of the existence of a logic characteristic of operational research techniques, believing that they have no special logic and that they have the same status as myths, witchcraft, religion, and science. We also view rational explanations as a product of the Enlightenment, and as such are guilty of all the errors attributed to it, of which there is a long history. Rational approaches are dominating and oppressive, and will always be brutal to someone or other. First off, notice that myths, witchcraft, religion, and science are put in the same dustbin. Yet I am willing to bet that when sick, most postmodernists will rely on medical science, not on witchcraft. Second, rational explanations, although central to the project of the Enlightenment, were most emphatically not an invention of that cultural movement. Western philosophy from the pre-Socratics and especially Plato onward has always been about rational explanations. And why, one might ask, should rationality be oppressive and brutal as opposed to liberating and helpful? Because, as White and Tackett inform us in a few lines later, words, reason, and rationality are inconsistent with emotions, feelings, creativity, and so on. Inconsistent? Certainly, reason is not the same thing as emotion, but philosophers ever since David Hume and modern neuroscientists like Antonio Damasio have convincingly argued that reason and emotions are both essential components of being human, and that they need to be brought into balance for a human being to function properly. Hume famously said that we speak not strictly and philosophically when we talk of the combat of passion and of reason. Reason is, and ought only to be, the slave of the passions, and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. A surprising stance for a philosopher of the much maligned Enlightenment. What Hume meant was that reason may provide us with the most effective means to achieve a particular end, but we care to reach that end because of a passion that we hold and that motivates us. Similarly, modern neurobiological research has brought Damasio to conclude that the very essence of human consciousness has its roots in a continuous balance between our emotions and our ability to reason. We can now map which areas of the brain are involved in rational decision-making, largely the frontal lobes, and show that they are intricately interconnected with the neurological seat of the emotions, primarily the amygdala. But of course, all of this assumes that you think that modern science is a few notches more sophisticated than witchcraft. From the postmodernist standpoint, the very concept of expertise is a recent, artificial creation. Following the project of Foucault, others have shown that the concept of expertise is not a natural one, in that it only erupted in certain fields at particular points in history, and its form is unstable. The expert is a modern figure, emerging in the 19th century, a creation of liberal discourses who plays an integral part in governing and controlling individuals and populations at a distance through the establishment of a network of experts. Really? Let us leave aside the final paranoid statement conjuring up a worldwide cabala of experts in what? Bent on world domination. Foucault and company are simply wrong to trace the concept of expertise or the social role of experts to the 19th century, as we saw at the beginning of this chapter. Socrates posed the question of what makes an expert 25 centuries ago, well before modern liberal discourse, and presumably because people even then did consider, rightly or wrongly, some fellow human beings as experts in, say, medicine. Moreover, what does it mean to dismiss expertise on the grounds that it is not natural? Neither is the computer on which I am writing this chapter, or I'm pretty sure whatever instrument White and Tackett used to write their essay. I'm beginning to sound repetitive, but we have yet another example of a previously encountered logical fallacy, the naturalistic one, or the equation of what is natural and what is good. How about poisonous mushrooms? Perhaps the most paradoxical part of White and Tackett's article, though, is when they actually attempt to do what one would think is contrary to their whole point. They give us a definition of a postmodern expert. Following Funtowitz and Ravitz, the postmodern expert is a person who happens to be able to have an experience. Being able to have an experience qualifies one as an expert? No wonder later on they conclude that a postmodern operational research program might appear interesting and fascinating. It might also appear ridiculous and absurd. We make no attempt here to distinguish between them. Of course not. If one accepts the postmodernist worldview, on what basis could such distinction possibly be made? Back to reality. Once again, how do we tell an expert from a phony? As we have seen, one can do really unsound philosophy while talking about expertise, as in the case of White and Tackett. However, the question is not wholly empirical either. While scientific studies of expertise, such as those discussed early on in this chapter, are certainly valuable and often intriguing, they cannot settle the question of most concern to us here. How is the person on the street, so-called, supposed to tell whether an alleged expert is right? Moreover, how should we make up our minds when experts seem to disagree on the matter at hand? In this book, we have faced precisely this situation several times. Are we to go with biochemist Michael Behe, a supporter of intelligent design, or with cell biologist Ken Miller, a supporter of evolution? After all, both have legitimate PhDs. Both teach at respected universities, and both have published in peer-reviewed journals. Should we conclude from this that the matter is so much up in the air that at this moment there is no reasonable way to take sides in the debate between creationism and evolution? If the reader has made it this far, she knows that my answer is most definitely negative. Behe is spectacularly wrong, and Miller is largely, but not entirely, right. But how do I know? Some interesting light on this question can be shed by the philosophical analysis of expertise provided by Alvin Goldman. Goldman begins by departing from the classical philosophical approach to epistemological problems such as this one. He rightly says that in classical epistemology, one makes the assumption that all agents are perfectly rational, and that they have unlimited logical competence. This is somewhat similar to the simplistic assumption underlying much classic economic theory, namely that market agents are perfectly rational and have access to all the relevant information about the companies, resources, capitals, and other factors that comprise the market. But just like markets are most certainly not made of perfectly rational agents, which is why economic predictions have a spectacular tendency to fail, as we have been painfully reminded in recent times, neither can we assume that non-experts in a field are characterized by perfect logical competence to assess all the relevant facts. So, what is an imperfect epistemic agent to do? Goldman's answer is that it is largely evidence about the speaker or writer instead of evidence about the matter at hand that allows us to reasonably make up our mind on whether, say, Behe or Miller are more likely to be right. That's because, as Goldman puts it, the novice either has no opinions in the target domain or does not have enough confidence in his opinions in this domain. Or, I would add, shouldn't have confidence in his opinions precisely because he is no expert on the matter and the matter is intricate enough to require expertise. Before proceeding with his recommendations on how to judge whether an expert is likely to be on track or not, we need to take a look at Goldman's very definition of expertise, which is intuitively appealing and provides in itself some useful insight into the issue. Goldman says that expertise is a question of veritistic terms, philosophical jargon for truth-linked assertions. In other words, someone can be considered an expert in a particular domain if two conditions are met. One, that person holds to more true beliefs and fewer false beliefs about that domain than a non-expert. Two, that person holds a substantial body of truths in that domain. This may seem a bit vague, but it implies two facts that intuitively one would want to be part of the idea of expertise. The first condition means that in order to qualify as an expert, someone has to know things better than most people when it comes to a particular domain. If I claim to be an expert in baseball, I am not, I ought to get a lot more things right about all aspects of baseball, and fewer things wrong when compared to someone who admits he is no baseball expert. But that is not enough, because one could know more than someone else and still not know nearly enough to be an expert. One could be a good amateur or just have an occasional interest in the matter. Hence, the second condition, which ensures that there is a substantial body of domain-specific knowledge in the toolkit of the alleged expert. Let us now turn to the core of Goldman's proposal, his 5-point guide to figuring out whether your trust in a prospective expert is well-founded or not. The 5 kinds of evidence that a novice can use to determine whether someone is a trustworthy expert are an examination of the arguments presented by the expert and his rival or rivals, evidence of agreement by other experts, some independent evidence that the expert is, indeed, an expert, an investigation into what biases the expert may have concerning the question at hand, the track record of the expert. Every so often, all one needs is the first criterion. We, as non-experts, are sometimes able to tell whether an alleged expert's arguments hold up to even superficial scrutiny, what Goldman calls direct argumentative justification. And we may be able to tell he is a phony even if we are not capable of directly refuting his arguments. Goldman's indirect argumentative justification. For instance, A politician is, under ideal circumstances, an expert in public policy, someone who wishes to convince us that he has a better idea than his opponents about how to run the public thing, as ancient Romans used to call the state. It isn't as easy as one might wish to spot a phony politician, or simply a politician whose ideas are confused or wrong, because most members of the public do not know enough specifics about economics, foreign affairs, laws, etc., to make a judgment by direct justification. To complicate things, judgments by indirect justification, for instance, based on how articulate the politician in question is, are suspect, because the art of politics is closely allied to the art of rhetoric, so effectively criticized by philosophers ever since Socrates. Nonetheless, an informed public may still be able to make inroads about the reliability of a particular politician by using both components of Goldman's first criterion. To begin with, most politicians are actually not more knowledgeable about, say, economics or foreign affairs than the rest of us. This means that several of their arguments can be evaluated directly, if only one bothers to pay attention and inform oneself. Moreover, politicians can sometimes be caught in flagrant contradictions on the basis of what they say to different audiences, which means that even an indirect analysis may reveal that there is something fishy going on. The problem with Goldman's first approach comes when we turn to more esoteric realms, such as the debates on evolution or global warming that we considered previously. There, most people really do not have the technical background necessary for a direct evaluation of the arguments, and indirect techniques often fail because, for instance, a creationist evangelical preacher is likely to be much more rhetorically skilled than an academic professor who rarely leaves the ivory tower. While there is much to be said for encouraging academics to get out into the real world and talk to people, they are simply not trained in rhetoric, and they usually, though not always, are unable to effectively rebut so-called common sense arguments advanced by the other side. We are then on to Goldman's second criterion. Look for evidence of agreement among experts. It works like this. You may be convinced that your car doesn't start because of a problem with the carburetor. But if several car mechanics tell you that your carburetor is fine and that instead you need to replace, say, the injection pump, you'd be a fool if you went ahead and bought a new carburetor. However, as we have seen when talking about both evolution and global warming, it is all too easy to find at least some experts who will defend almost any sort of nonsense. The annals of science are littered with, sometimes even prominent, scientists being taken in by one crackpot idea or another. Just think of Newton's fascination with alchemy, or Alfred Russel Wallace's, the co-discoverer with Darwin of natural selection, defense of spiritualism. This is why creationists and supporters of intelligent design play the game of gathering signatures from experts who criticize evolutionary theory. Often, such criticisms are phrased in such generic terms that one would have to be hard-pressed not to sign on, even if one were a hardcore evolutionary biologist. For instance, scientists sometimes are asked to endorse statements to the effect that critical examination of scientific theories ought to be taught to high school students. What scientist could possibly object to the use of critical thinking in schools? But the real issue is why the authors of such petitions usually single out only the theory of evolution for scrutiny, and not the theory of gravity or the germ theory of disease, for example. Why the focus on evolution if there really is no ideological agenda propelling them? Goldman's third criterion may be helpful here. Look at the independent evidence that the expert is, in fact, an expert. That immediately rules out most creationists and ID supporters. The overwhelming majority of them do not have degrees in the sciences, and some of them, like the infamous Dr. Kent Dino Hovind, whom I've had the dubious honor of debating in public more than once, actually have degrees from unaccredited university. Hovind sports a PhD in Bible studies from Patriot University, which turns out to be someone's house. Even those that do have degrees, such as Dwayne Gish of the Institute for Creation Research, or Bill Dembski of the Discovery Institute, have acquired them in unrelated fields, biochemistry and philosophy, respectively. A PhD in biochemistry does not make someone an expert in evolutionary biology, any more than my PhD in evolutionary biology makes me an expert in biochemistry. Trust me, I'm not. This still leaves a small number of experts with good credentials, graduate degrees in the appropriate discipline from accredited universities, who turn out to be creationists. But here we can go back to Goldman's second criterion and follow his suggestion to survey the field. If the overwhelming majority of accredited experts sides one way, that way is the most likely bet to make. Incidentally, this is by no means to say that the majority of experts are always right, far from it. The history of science provides several examples where most authorities in a given field endorsed the wrong theory at one time or another. Most astronomers in Galileo's time thought the Italian scientists got it wrong, but time vindicated Galileo. However, this occasional turn of events cannot be used to justify a systematic rejection of expert opinion. To do so is to engage in what some philosophers informally call the Van Gogh fallacy. It goes like this. Van Gogh was an artistic genius, and yet he died penniless. I am a penniless artist, therefore I am a genius. A moment's reflection should convince you that the conclusion simply does not follow from the premise, and you can substitute Galileo, scientific genius, and was shunned by critics in the phrases above without changing the logical outcome at all. When we move on to Goldman's fourth criterion, we find an apparent obvious mistake, especially for a philosopher. Goldman tells us that one ought to look for evidence of bias, ideological, financial, or of any other kind, that may affect an expert's opinion. His example is of a study published in 1999 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, in which the authors surveyed research on anti-cancer drugs, keeping track of where the funding for the research was coming from. The results were perhaps not surprising to anyone who appreciates human nature, but embarrassing to the medical research community nonetheless. 38% of the studies sponsored by nonprofit organizations, such as the federal government, yielded negative results about the efficacy of the tested drugs, while only 5% of the studies sponsored by the pharmaceutical industry turned out no effect. If you think the difference is due to chance, I have a beautiful and sturdy bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you. Now, before the postmodernists among us jump up to shout, "I told you so," let me point out a couple of things. First, no scientist would really be surprised by the outcome of the study. As we have seen, because science is a human activity, one should expect human biases to enter into it. But, and this is the second point, notice that just like the Piltdown forgery about a fake pre-human ancestor was uncovered by scientists, not creationists, so the 1999 study in JAMA was done by scientists, not postmodernists. It is science's ability of self-evaluation, self-criticism, and self-correction that once again shows us both the power and the limits of the scientific enterprise itself. Moreover, the fact of the matter is that it is simply not possible to find any human being entirely without biases. Bias is a pejorative term, but more broadly, it reflects the fact that we all come with, more or less well-founded, opinions, and that we can't help but see the world through a series of partial, often distorting, filters. The question is not whether there is bias, there always is, but how much, where it comes from, and how one can become aware of and correct it. That is why I warned the reader about so-called think tanks earlier in the book. Too often, their political, ideological, and financial biases are not disclosed to the public, which gives them the misleading aura of being neutral third-party experts. Following this line of reasoning, however, both Goldman and I are dangerously close to committing the genetic fallacy mentioned above, that is, rejecting someone's arguments because of who makes the argument, rather than on the basis of why he makes it. John West, for instance, a fellow of the pro-ID think tank Discovery Institute, has written an entire book, Darwin Day in America, complaining about the alleged moral corrosion of modern society brought about by Darwinism. Have you noticed that I biased you against West by mentioning first that he is associated with a pro-creationist think tank? Well, was it bias or fair warning? In making up your mind about West's arguments, you should certainly read his book, but knowing that he has a strong ideological background that may predispose him to be anti-science, your baloney detector will be on high alert when you do, as it should be. By the same token, of course, you should consider my own political and philosophical views when reading what I write. And you can find a host of information on this topic on my blog, rationallyspeaking.org. Nonetheless, neither Goldman nor I are committing any fallacy. The difference is this. If one were to say that we ought to reject an argument solely because of the biases of who proposes said argument, then one would in fact be committing the genetic fallacy. One would also be left with few people to argue with, considering that pretty much everyone has one bias or another. But this is not what Goldman and I are saying. All we're proposing is that it is rational, if you believe in rationality, to be aware of the potential effects of a variety of sources of bias, just as the JAMA article clearly demonstrated. So the awareness of bias is not an argument against someone's position, as much as a warning signal that we need to pay close attention to his reasoning and evidence, because they may not be as sound or convincing as they might at first glance appear. Just a common sense form of critical thinking. Lastly, let's look at the fifth source of evidence available to an intelligent novice attempting to figure out how much trust to put in a self-professed expert: track record. We do this all the time in everyday situations. We keep going to the same mechanic because he has been pretty successful at fixing problems with our car. Had he not been, we would have looked for another mechanic. Of course, like every tool described so far, this one needs to be used with caution. A common misuse is what I refer to above as the Nobel effect, by which people are inclined to accept the pronouncement of a Nobel laureate, even if it is in a field remote from the one for which the person in question won the Nobel. The reasoning must go something like this. This person won the Nobel, say, for research in cancer biology, so this person must be smart. Therefore, he is probably right about what he just said about, say, economics. This simply does not follow. Someone most certainly must be intelligent, under whatever definition of intelligence we wish to use, to win the Nobel. But intelligence is not the same thing as expertise, And while winning the Nobel in Medicine requires expertise in that discipline, it says nothing at all about that person's expertise in a different field, such as economics. Indeed, it suggests that the biologist in question probably is not an expert in economics because, as we have seen, it takes a lifetime of effort to be an expert in either biology or economics, and most of us don't seem to find the equivalent of two lifetimes to devote to disparate professions. On top of this, of course, past success does not guarantee future success. Your mechanic may have been infallible so far, and yet he may have finally encountered a problem about your car that he can't solve. He is still an expert, though, and it would be unwise of you to discard his advice, unless he begins consistently to get things wrong. Goldman is well aware that his five recommendations do not provide us with an airtight method of telling expertise from flimflammery. Indeed, this whole essay is an argument that there is no such foolproof method. But Goldman invites the reader to use what philosophers call inference to the best explanation, an approach that seeks to weigh all the available evidence and then make an educated guess about which way the truth lies. This is essentially the same method immortalized by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in his Sherlock Holmes stories, and which Doyle erroneously referred to as induction. When Holmes says in Silver Blaze, "Improbable as it is, all other explanations are more improbable still," he is making an inference to the best explanation compatible with the data as it is available to him. And he is well aware that he needs good information before it becomes possible to arrive at a reasonable inference. In The Adventure of the Copper Beeches, Holmes complains, "Data, data, data. I can't make bricks without clay." Then again, Holmes' creator himself was not above making major blunders when it came to science and pseudoscience. Conan Doyle famously believed literally in fairies on the grounds that there existed empirical evidence of their appearances in the form of fake, as it unsurprisingly turned out, photographs.